Welcome back to the O'Delay Show. It's December 17th, 2020. Topic today, again, more or less, is war funding and context thereabout. First question of today. With no democratic restraint on congressional spending, how can the governing body possibly operate in the best interest of those whom it's intended to represent? Answer: cannot. Take a look at the website, usdebtclock.org, for instance. The three largest federal budget items are, as indicated there, among other interesting facts, are first, Medicare Medicaid budget at about $1.3 trillion annual dollars. Second, Social Security budget at about $1.1 trillion per year. And third, the overt defense or war budget, more plainly speaking, at about $750 billion this year. That's first place for government health care funding for the elderly and otherwise dependent citizenry, second place for minimal stipending of the elderly or otherwise dependent citizenry, and third place for the maintenance of a standing global military and the prosecution of many long-running foreign and domestic wars. That's the overt budget. Second question. Is it in the best interest of the citizens of the United States for the country to maintain a global standing military presence with nearly 1,000 military bases worldwide, along with prosecuting various decades-long hot wars, military interventions, paramilitary political regime changes, and proxy military occupations? Second answer, no. Again. Those who think so are a slim minority of rich fascist internationalists, or foolish nationalist dupes who themselves maintain an occupation of the United States national government for the cause of sustaining the empire for their own thrills one way or another, basically. The military occupation is propped up in the Congress and the White House with corporate money, which also represents a relatively slim minority. The occupation of the national government is propped up by various foreign war interests and foreign intelligence assets, which add to the false appearance of a plurality of ideology in Washington, D.C. The practical result of endless war and endless empire is death and destruction for all of humankind on Earth, never mind individual nation states, which means the effective political goal or result isn't total anarchy, for better or worse, depending on your brand and spin, but rather an apocalyptic eschatology in which metaphysically nothing survives. If the federal government was required to be concerned about its and held to it about its spending on things that are in opposition to any rational or vested interest in the citizenry, or on the part of the citizenry, then it wouldn't be so easy to do something like what it did last week. As we discussed last week on this program, what it did last week in the United States House of Representatives, the legislative body approved another year's worth of annual national defense authorization funding legislation this year with the taxpayer price tag of $750 billion, just like is effectively represented in the debt clock, usdebtclock.org website, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. Not only in support of existing United States wars in the Mideast, along with all the rest of the foreign imperial footprint, but also to allocate billions of new dollars, just, this is one among many. I haven't read the whole thing yet. Looking at the table of contents is a good way to brief yourself on the 4,500-page document I have found. But also to allocate billions of new dollars, for example, this is one writer, to escalate an aggressive military buildup that's antagonistic to mainland China. Namely, reestablishing the United States Navy First Fleet in the Pacific, reminiscent of the World War II posturing in the Orient. Both chambers of the United States have forwarded this year's National Defense Authorization Act with overwhelming approval, veto-proof, it is said, statutorily veto-proof, against a backdrop of a remarkably and increasingly failed domestic economy and an increasingly precarious domestic police and surveillance state, and an unprecedentedly disturbing measure of civil unrest, all of which the various elongated United States wars and military occupations have both catalyzed and are sustaining. theoretically, a key legal remedy, and this goes this far askew, would be in the hands of the United States voters, who unfortunately and for too many decades have repeatedly allowed these people, or been voluntold in some vicarious sense, or duped or misled, in any event, compelled one way or another, to allow these people back into the legislature. I mean, they're there by vote, popular vote, to such an extent that the legacy partisan incumbents feel entitled to their political cottage industry. Thus, the much-needed drastic national policy change is virtually impossible. These people feel entitled to it, and therefore they feel that it's entitled that their parties, their corporate parties, secure their path back to there, even though what they're doing is not in the interest of the nation whatsoever. Has been for a long time. Additional fatal twist, and it's getting worse, an additional fatal twist is that the United States executive office is concurrently permanently occupied by the deep state war state, seemingly more so, evidently more so, way more so than any other deep state special interest in the clouds the direction and thought of the executive. Moreover, the White House prosecutes clandestine wars and political regime change operations using secret budgets that aren't included within the National Defense Authorization Act, and which the voters cannot audit, much less for which can they provide informed consent. Certainly, they're small little caucuses in the legislature. They glad hand and backslap that stuff. The people who operate in the name of the best interest of the nation and in the name of the people, against the best interests of the nation and against the people, which is high hypocrisy. They can all go to hell. Certainly, the executive is also occupied by decades-long overt wars and military occupations, as above mentioned. All of this business is unconstitutional, extraordinary, illegal, unethical, expensive, foolish, and destructive, among other modifiers, and it's all done in the name of the people of the United States, ultimately at the expense of this country's legitimacy, ethical standing, and in the international community. The freedom of the citizenry now and in the future, the civil liberties of all people, and the peace and survival of all inhabitants of the world, and the survival of human civilization on Earth, full stop. This is the national political status, and it's the status at a time when the engineering problems facing humanity require the collaboration of all hands on deck, for all shareholders, that is, not just in this nation, but all around the world, to demonstrate restraint and civility in order to hopefully better ensure the survival of humanity and better sustain the world that is civil and bearable and in the context in which the United States coexists with other peoples and nations and factors and realities and futures. Meanwhile, the politically appointed judicial branch is appointed by the corporate partisan executive and approved by the corporate partisan legislature. And these corporate partisans are split into two different nomenclature monikers, which the corporations hedge on those. The international money hedges on those so that it doesn't really matter what Americans think that they've voted one way or the other. It's split literally 50-50 these days. It's just perfectly split like that. It's no accident. That's gerrymandering in a modern sense. It's not in the sense that you move your district lines, but that you egg up the constituency in such a way that, you know, you get a 50-50. Excuse me. The Supreme Court expounds the idea that money is political speech, and I harp on that frequently. Citizens United? An interpretation which effectively paints every individual citizen who is not independently wealthy as a doomed street whore at best, financially and politically. That's what goes on. You don't have to study economics for long, class for long, modern America for long, a history of Western civilization for long to realize that. So we've rolled back to pre-civil rights, pre-civil liberties, like, if not pre-Magna Carta. Not to be outdone by the average historically and politically uneducated and confused children of America, in the Supreme Court, modernized contemporary identity politics and rolling back of long-settled civil liberties case law seems to rule the roost, or at least dominate the spirit of judicial appointments in the federal courts. These appointments have become a circus sideshow and a travesty of justice. And the court, they represent the special interests who represent the election of the people in the Congress and the White House. And they demonstrate no more concern for liberty than do the White House as an institution these days, nor the Congress. They don't care. With all three branches out of order, as they, and I, look, I'm all for Western civilization, okay? And those liberal ideals, like habeas corpus, and leave people alone, you know, and no state religion. But with the fall of the world like it is now, the countries with state religions are the only one, by sheer mass, the ones that will survive. Because of the occupation and the compromise of the libertarian ideals that the United States was founded upon. Well, without that, and then you don't have a state religion, then you really are done for. Because you don't have Stalin, and you don't have that Bolshevik secular machine drive, and you don't have Mao's Cultural Revolution, and you don't have a caliphate. You've got a bunch of ugly, rich, spoiled, stupid Americans. So if you want to start removing from the very core operating or institutions, removing from it the philosophy that it was based on and that replaced those older ways, well, that's the story. It doesn't end well for us. And with all three branches out of order as they hang twisted from the gallows of special interest, corporate plutocrats and partisan fools, there seems little effective timely recourse for the United States voters by way of the prescribed venues. So there is an ongoing flurry of many revolutions that are doing more to further fracture the citizenry and destabilize the domestic peace. None of it works as prescribed, and so voting has become a comparably wanton, philosophically speaking, as comparably wanton as throwing rocks at riot police. Now, both activities are just futile things, which some people do because they don't have a political voice of their own. Young people see that incivility as a legitimate means of political action, and often, and not just young people, and often as the most likely to render some sort of reaction or attention, however misguided or obtuse. Well, when the elected officials in Washington, D.C. betray the best interest and will of virtually all Americans by, again, cheerleading the National Defense Authorization Act into a new decade, well, then it's no surprise that young, impressionable, or otherwise precarious citizenry notices that the voting in the national political machine in general, moreover, is grossly ineffective. We know some very small portion of the so-called American patriots want to enslave and kill the world using the United States as its weapon. I would say that's not patriotic. It's my official professional opinion. But that reality of using the United States as a weapon for Armageddon simply reinforces the fact that the national popular vote is not a democratic scenario, which it effectively demonstrates and is driven by the will of the people, which I think is due mostly to the manipulation of self-interested Democratic and Republican corporate political machines, which it is. There was nobody on the ballot whom you could vote for last month who would fix any of this. And that, if you're looking at no one person and no one executive, I mean, that was a one election, O-N-E. That's one elector. But no matter what, the wars were going to continue. So that's out of control. You know, Congress is who is supposed to be able to declare war, but with all these NIVA ways of prosecuting wars, Congress gets bypassed or is complicit. Ron Paul Iraq War One, wrote up a declaration of war, which they would laugh at. So they don't need that stinking paper. Well, at least it would have been a constitutional thing, and it would have given a forensic benchmark for toggling the thing off. It's been unable to toggle the thing off because it was never properly toggled on, and it's been 20 years nearly. That was the point of that, and that's the point of that being written into the founding document, because they knew on the old European continent, the founding fathers and their spouses and spices knew that this is how politics went over there for long centuries. And over in, you know, the history of Western Civ for long, you know, millennia. You got to have a way to keep the war in check because it preys upon and is too tempting for the human psyche otherwise, especially at the government level when you can separate yourself from the murder in the streets and the subjugation and casting out of whole civilizations who are lower than your social class. Just too tempting. So many, it seems, for most, and for has been for thousands of years. That's one of the things that was supposed to have set the United States apart and why we could say what we said when the country was founded. So many known venues for peaceful civil dissent or discourse, whether traditional or modern, are gone, deplatformed, or occupied by special interests. And do you get the feeling you're being not just watched, but actively experimented on? It's because you are, various ways. This marginalizes and radicalizes people. It also feeds back into the original problem of corruption. Corruption at the government level trickles down. Okay? It do. People's rejection of and displeasure with the state causes a widespread cynicism which is difficult to penetrate, and that in itself is a huge source of the cynicism and corruption in officialdom to begin with. It unnecessarily causes very large patches of the future to be occluded with doom and misery. Voting isn't working. Civil demonstrations increase. The surveillance state and police state sweep it up. The injustice of that then feeding back into the unresolved negative cycle. There's collateral damage, but the war state soldiers on, both in the home front and abroad. Who's to stop it? People aren't part of the algorithm which is governing our nation anymore, if they were, in the modern times. And at least they're calculated as expendable, and not just people, but peoples. Morally, this is, and now, not just peoples outside, but peoples inside, in the lower 48. Morally, it's true. Citizens and aliens alike, as I said. I have a little point to make here for the second half of today's show. Here we go. Under the breach. This year's military budget's a 4,500-page document, and there are many writers within it. As I said, that's a long thing to read, but look at the table of contents. That's a good way, I would say. There's also a report that's like, you know, a 700-800 report, page report that's up there. I posted a link to on the previous show. But look at that. I mean, it's kind of a legalistic agate, which I think you'd, for all intents and purposes, for my purposes anyway, unless you want to go check the details of one or another of them, just read the table of contents. And it's the overt military budget. Any guesses or bets as to whether the covert one is a longer document? I bet it is. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it isn't. Certainly could be longer. It's going to be more detailed, right? I don't know. Why would you put an explanation of what you're doing in your covert wars and your covert war budget? Or why even write the budget down to begin with? I don't know. That's not what the show's about. We do have the overt one. We can put hands on it. So one of the writers in this year's NDAA that we've been talking about for the past couple of weeks stipulates that... Are you ready? You ready? Okay. Check your watch. That military bases named after the Southern Confederate personnel of the United States Civil War must have their names changed within 3 years. And it is because of this rider that the President, President Trump, has threatened to veto the National Defense Authorization Act, although I'd rather hear him condemn it on the grounds of the endless wars. But anyway, as I noted, I hear it's a veto-proof approval in the legislature. So, doesn't matter, but there is some, there's been some missives from the Oval Office that say, I'll veto, you know, from President. So, but like I said, I'm told it's a veto-proof scenario. And, I mean, it's it's the bread and butter of what makes what's left of this nation, or what this nation's become, go anyway. Why would the people who have stolen control relinquish now that they have it? Right? Why would they? So I offer the following consideration regarding those, change the names of those United States military bases, ones that are named after Confederate personnel. So those bases in former Confederate states memorialize the horrible losses by the Confederacy during the war, you know, or in battles where there were horrible losses on both sides. And states, often as not, if not entirely, where those names are an important part of the local history, certainly the local military history, respectfully. That business comes up in military culture, in American military culture. If you didn't know, you need to know that. Okay, it's part of the tacit, implicit inner mechanization of the history of the United States military, and it's very real part of the philosophy that goes on. Civil War wasn't that long ago, okay? Also, frankly, those names serve as a reminder for those who understand the complexities of American history that the overall context of the Civil War was not as innocent with respect to race nor various other issues that it involved, as is often suggested in modern political culture, popular culture. So neither so innocent, for that matter, have been the European colonization in the Americas, obviously. I mean, that's no mystery. Legislation is ostensibly driven by popular modern identity politics and cultural appropriation for the purpose of demonstrating some perceived moral high ground on the part of a specific cultural background or ethnicity, whether white or black or otherwise, is pure folly. And then again, so is letting redacted entry pass for an historical edifice, or facts, for that matter. The Cleveland Indians, Major League Baseball, are going to change their name. I read in a headline today on a Microsoft news ticker. Well, cultural appropriation is a thing. And it's not just relegated to race. In the name of full disclosure, I'll say my deoxyribonucleic acid, my DNA, is 38% Scottish, 36% English and Northwestern European, 10% Irish, and I would have thought that number would have been higher, 8% Germanic European, 7% Welsh, right? And 1% Benin and Togo African. As a bit of a leftist when I was a youth, and as a lifelong libertarian, a working local journalist for a reporter for nearly two decades, and a civil rights, and before I became an educator, and a civil rights and liberties advocate born and raised in Texas, I have experienced, which is in the Deep South, I have experienced much antagonism for my multicultural political leanings. Okay? I'm a Gen Xer. I was born after civil rights. I was born around the fall of Saigon. I went to a former consolidated high school, which still bore the name, still does today, which was a racially integrated high school. I mean, by the time I was there, it was like, well, it's just, you know, it's kind of an artifact because it was a foregone conclusion that public schools were integrated. They all are. But that one was still named Consolidated because it was old enough to have been named that when it was a distinct thing. I know what it's like for black and white cultures to cohabitate harmoniously in a community, and how critical that good time made in cohabitation and collaboration among races culturally and exchange in such a way is for the... I know how good that is for the healing and the... moving forward positively of race relations and the burying of old hatchets. Alternatively, I also know firsthand how damaging it is to reignite old, settled, race-based oddsmanship after it's already been buried and can be dealt with purely in a historical fashion and not in a real politic, aggressive civil war, you know, fashion, whether it's this kind of cold civil war that you got today, which is getting less and less cold, in my opinion, every moment. But anyway, I know firsthand how damaging it is to reignite those things and how needlessly it causes a revisiting of things that have been, that there was a lot of tears and blood that, you know, prior to healing, where peace has already been carefully made. This is reckless when you revisit that in bad faith. And doing so is most definitely will serve as a party to blood libel among the races. I mean, like I said, I saw where there was cultural cohabitation doing well, and that's the way of the survival of humanity and this nation in the future. And that's the nature of the American South today. It's known for that. There are also pockets where it's known for there's still Jim Crow. We'll talk about that in the next minute. And so it has a tendency to kind of spill out and spread and kind of be bred forward. And that's what I mean. It'll increase. I mean, because it is not 100% solved in the South. Or in, for that matter, is there racism in Detroit, up in the North? I've never been there, man. You tell me. Okay, so it's not settled for everybody. But there has been progressive healing in the South where I'm from. And I can see that and I can say that firsthand. I also know what modern Jim Crow looks like. It's typically only implied, right? Because, and it still exists, of course. I've talked about this on the show before. It's typically only implied because the separate but equal approach was declared unconstitutional. A lot of the times, people are like, that's the only way it works. So if you differ from that implicit separate but equal approach, if you're in an institution, whatever you're doing there, you will be violently, you know, rooted out. I mean, with all things but putting hands on. Like, you'll just find yourself out of work. And your family implicitly threatened. And you'll pay social costs. And it's because you violated it separate but equal. That's one of the reasons separate but equal was ruled unconstitutional, because that sword cuts both ways. So in modern times, separate but equal, which does exist often, because for a long time, that was the resolution to the problem of race in the United States. So separate but equal is not going to be explicitly posted. And where it does exist as a local way of things, and it still does, it can easily spread because it's implicit and kind of creeps. And people begin to follow habitually those way of things because they're just semiotically put where they're safe. And then they enforce it unconsciously. But what they're really doing, and there are people who know what it is, and they're spreading that and reinforcing it. Rural Arizona, where I live now, for example, is an example of a place where separate but equals, not uncommon political encounter for various demographics, okay? I mean, and I'm not just talking black and white. I mean, it's one way of it. However, one never sees it posted explicitly anywhere, right? As I said 10 times. And many people don't realize they're among it when they are, because they're accustomed to it. It's like you don't see the prostitutes that are obvious to those who are looking for them and know they're looking for, or to, you know, are looking for work. So, but those who do realize what they're seeing, they generally gonna bite it. That's not because it's the prevailing local social construct, and it's that's real politic, and survival's a thing that either happens or doesn't for the operator who's making these decisions in the marketplace of ideas with the local cottage industry. And it's an implied moral code with unstated, unknown, and often wide-ranging consequences depending on you where you are, and you're not enforcing it, you're not from there. If you happen to live there, you just kind of suffer it until you move. So that transgression of it, transgression of the separate but equal implicit more, is a terrible gamble if you know. Or if you're just speaking on it from your heart or on faith, that's also, I mean, you'll be made to pay. More straightforward semiotics are easier to see and easier to address through due process general civics, regardless of whether they're historical or memorial markers or modern statute. Okay? They can be objectified, declawed, and used to teach. And to discuss. And to shine a light. But the implicit, edited version, I'm not recommending it. Intellectually, academically, sociologically, not at all, absolutely. This is what I've been saying. Like I said, for the second half of the show, that's what we're talking about. Therefore, on this subject, With respect to the aforementioned about my history, I do not issue lightly, nor do I without a lifetime's work worth of forethought and social science investigation, scholarship among the humanities, and field work. Okay. My perspective. So my own lifestyle, career, and the ensuing political exposure of myself and my family members are all intimately correlated, as I said, with my advocacy for preserving the multiculturalism within the United States. And I've paid a cost for it, a real political cost for it, throughout my whole life. And with such a conviction also comes a responsibility for dealing respectfully, directly, civilly, and honestly with the past, present, future, and with the philosophical restraint and patience and care that's often required when mending race relations. So I'll have students who are just, they're just convinced I'm a racist because I'm white. And I have younger people, you know, my own kids. They're like, you're such a racist. Well, no, I'm trying to demonstrate that's not true. You know, I have convictions and I have made exchanges for the sake and against. I have convictions against it. Strong ones that have governed the path of my career. And as I said before, but the media teaches people in these identity politics, teaches people to think in terms of black, white, like literally like shark, black and white vision, like just based on color. Well, they fit this mold. That's just all stereotypes. That's all it is. And that's the problem with just everyone virtual learning forever. You don't get any organic analog experience, instruction. So the wisdom is based, it's all hearsay. That people still today use the painful atrocity or, you know, the reality of 19th century slavery to not only race bait and divide the American people who are one nation, but also to advocate some agenda for stronger centralized federal government makes a mockery of the history of black people, African Americans, all U.S. citizens from any culture, and it's an affront to all thinking people. And it's a disservice to the rampant human trafficking that goes on today, one of the biggest industries in the world. So that very sort of stronger centralized federal government, by the way, such as what is currently driving the out-of-control U.S. war machine, has led to such geopolitical instability increasingly that there are now, for the first time in a long time, recently now, open-air slave markets reopen in North Africa. All right? This is the lead of the year, this fact, or whenever it was. I mean, it's that Libya instability that began under Obama and when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, and they wanted to look cool and they wanted to start an additional war in the Middle East and North Africa, so they did. And it area and it, Mahatma Gandhi, excuse me, Muammar Gaddafi was sodomized by a bayonet, and you know, the CIA point person for Reagan, and finally, it was just, you know, he's ours, so we can kill him to make an example of ourselves, the modern war hawk Democrats, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And so they did. And that place is a free-for-all. And there are now open-air slave markets in North Africa as a result of it. So I said the lead of the year, but that's kind of gotten to be old news if you consider 4 years ago old news. Anyway, and longer. I mean, it's been 4 years since pretty much to the month since Mr. Obama left office. The United States abolitionists of the 19th century were in the right, of course, just as anyone or organization, anything is more ethical than any other thing which advocates for endless war or oppression of any type. But the grounds, the context, and results of our civil war were far more complex than the single issue of slavery. And the capital impasse leading up to that war was states' rights in general, individual states' rights. Slavery abolition was an ongoing international movement in the 19th century, okay, albeit politically favorable wind blowing for the North. And all of this conversation about 19th century slavery now being used to incite and roll back some of the healing that have been here, when we have levels of instability that are not perfect and they've gotten much worse lately, exponentially so, I am very skeptical of it, because the same body politics that are bringing that up and floating this rider on this NDAA are the same ones that are contributing to a global economy that has led to open air slave markets reopening. And in a context of an increasingly rampant, because of the widespread unemployment precarity, sex trafficking and human trafficking industry. I mean, I live 30 minutes from the border here, from the southwestern border. It's definitely a thing. And it's always been a thing. And more people are finding that it is one of the only things that they have, while the demand for human trafficking comes from the top, people who can buy people. And those are the ruling class, so to speak, the oligarchs, the big capitalists. I mean, they're the ones who, you know, and that's what you teach. And that's how you buy people. Look, if you want to have the privilege to where you can go to a club and pick up somebody, you know, some working girl that'll pretend not to be a working girl for you, or vice versa, then you got to have the money. And that wealth is narrowly and narrowly more focused in just a few people, while the middle class is basically gone. And there are lots of people. I mean, it is a huge, huge class of people who don't have, just like back in like Victorian England. Well, that's was one of the only ways that you kind of, you know, the lower classes of women, that's the only thing that they could do to be economically independent. Go look on Tumblr. Go look it up, these social media. Go look around at what, and look at what's being sold in the media, in the audio video media about, you know, live that life. And that's what's being sold. That's Vice. Fever pitch. Political and partisan corruption in the national government, central bank and monopolies, and harsh and vindictive post-Civil War occupation are all issues which run very much deep still today. These military installations are named in memorial, are part of the healing of the defeated nation that was the Confederate States of America. And such utter defeat, culturally, economically, politically, could just as easily happen in the United States of America at any moment if we consider the future to be an unknown. So many who consider the future to be prefated would forecast the fall of any empire to come later, if not sooner. Therefore, to be honest about ourselves and our history, it serves everyone well if we wish to face the future successfully and in good standing. Poorly conceived ideological legislation impedes race relations in a political landscape that's already too incendiary and stilted. And our intellectual economy is, and always will be, merit-based. The renaming of installations will not make bigots disappear, but it will fan the flames of racial and historical ignorance and hatred, and it will pose a much more complicated and unlikely task for those people who want to better understand, moving forward, historical affairs, and to see the cultural, institutional, and historical realities as they do exist today in state. Those names and places are just as much a part of United States history as anything else, and they're a part of history whose recognition is an important aspect of understanding the past and healing for the future. It's a matter of respect for the dead on both ends of that war, and of the context and history of the late institutions. In their best and worst respects, they are going both ways. They're a clear reminder of what can happen to a nation politically divided and frustrated. A revisionist approach to culture and history is especially problematic in light of the increasingly unprecedented power grabs by the United States central government by way of powerful special capital and foreign interests which occupy the Congress and the White House, as well as by proxy, the judiciary, the appointed judiciary. There is a dangerous irony here that's being ignored. Global uniformity and conformance to these special interests and a blank slate cultural memory are being enforced under the boot of the United States military, both abroad and at home, upon both citizens and non-citizens. Such a so-called cleansing movement yields for no nation, no constituent, no person, and no lessons learned from wars past or present. It has no respect for the living or dead, no respect for peace, no ear for dissent, no place for novelty or variations in culture. It is a bottomless hole that will swallow the whole world if it is not mitigated more effectively. Trying to erase history with identity politics is an excellent recipe for further fragmentation and disenfranchisement of the citizenry. It seems obvious, therefore, I suspect that it is the ostensible purpose of the legislation floated from the same body politic in Washington, D.C. that sells out entire nations for their own personal political gain or thrill-seeking to include selling out this nation, and so I certainly don't trust their moral flagellation about slavery in the 19th century, not in the context that exists today. It's just going to make things worse. There are plenty of aspects about the past that I do not like, both as an individual and as a member of various pluralities, but I'm glad I know about these aspects. There are aspects about today I don't like, but I want to know about them. I don't want to be blissfully ignorant, which too many people are, which is why the leadership dynamic in the nation is the way it is. And therefore, the result is a decline and an end to the civil, peaceable way of life that we would like to maintain, if possible, and I don't think I'm pessimistic about it. However, recognizing the distinction between the past and present is crucial for competently, ethically, and accurately handling the realities of the world, navigating the marketplace of ideas, transmitting the truth to future generations. The Southern United States is in the middle of the 19th century and that of the early mid to 20th, were very different situations politically and culturally, and for very obvious reasons. Look at what you got now, and we want to see clear what exists. We want to clearly, objectively, get the full circumspection of history. And that's the only way you can move forward. And I got to tell you, with the way that the national steerage behaves, at least for at this time, whatever they say, you if you're just a statistically speaking, you're better off just to believe the opposite of what was just said to you. Thanks for listening, Odelay Show today. I'll try to catch you next week. Oh, I have a quote. These are the words of in salutation. These are the words of Rose Wilder Lane. War is caused by the ancient pagan belief that authority controls individuals and must and should control them. This belief is in individual minds, and no force whatever can change any man's mind. War will end when a majority of men on this earth know that every man is free. Each person must see for himself that everyone is self-controlling and responsible. So long as any large group of persons anywhere on this earth believe the ancient superstition that some authority is responsible for their welfare, they will set up some image of that authority and try to obey it. The result will be poverty and war.